The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Day three, deep in the mountains, seeing and hearing, tasting and touching. What is it? What is it? In this moment, aside from anything you can figure out, aside from any story you have made up about yourself or about this world, in this very moment, vast and subtle, hidden and obvious, right here, thousands of words and myriad interpretations are only to free us from delusion. And so we wander. We wander through this life. We wander through each period of Zazen, wandering without quite knowing what we're doing. Someone recently said to me, they said, "I don't understand what is going on here." And I said, "I don't understand it either." right here, it is going on. Pay no attention to the great sage of India. If you think she is somewhere else, you are lost in delusion. She, he, they are right here. This intimate transmission we speak about, intimately conveyed, is not something that happened 2,000 years ago. It's not something that happened this morning. But it is the substance and the liveliness of this very moment. This intimacy of the source world that can never be grasped, never be understood. Anything we say about it is wrong. But yet we point to it. All of these teachings are pointing to your life. I was thinking about these first two lines the jeweled mirror, of the Sandokai, the harmony of relative and absolute. In our translation from the Zen Center of Los Angeles, it's the great mind, the mind of the great sage of India is intimately conveyed from west to east. I thought another a looser translation might be, the wondrous light of life abides seamlessly within and without. The wondrous light of life, the wondrous heart of life, abides already here. Where is it? Where is it? We look everywhere, and the answer is here. Here. in this moment. And as I've been looking at different translations of this, it's been quite lovely. And for me, trying to convey as directly as possible what's important about this. All of this gobbledygook, all of these words, all of these concepts. So what? So what? Two translations had quite different translations of the title. One translation of, we say, so harmony of relative and absolute is the agreement for participating together. The agreement, this is the agreement for participating together. John Tarrant, our Dharma ancestor, Dharma grandfather, translates the title, not harmony of relative and absolute. He calls it taking part in the gathering. Taking part in the gathering. And I love both of these, this invitation to participate. And that's what all of this is about. This invitation, life is inviting you. Life has already invited you. And requires our willingness to receive. Melissa's wonderful instructions from the other day of our senses and Shito himself talking about the senses. This is not something esoteric we are talking about. This is not something hidden. If you do not see the road, you do not see it even as you walk on it. You say, I have no idea what this Buddhism is about. You say, right from the heart of the universe. There is not something outside of you to get. Another wonderful part of John Tarrant's translation, and it's actually, I think, probably John and Joan Sutherland together, on the part, the line that's, do not judge by any standards. Another one is, don't make up your own rules. But John and Joan say, don't limit yourself to your own small story. Don't limit yourself to your own small story, right? We've all made these stories. It's a sign of mental health. Congratulations, you have a story. This is an important and precious thing, your story, so precious. But don't limit yourself to your small story. You are being invited to the great dance of life, the great dance that beats your heart and flows through the thousands of miles of capillaries in your body, knowing just where to go, just what to do, this great easefulness that breathes your breath is already here. Want to read just one other part of John's translation, and it's in our translation, it's the subtle source is clear and bright, the tributary streams flow through the darkness. To be attached to things is illusion, to encounter the absolute is not yet enlightenment. John and Joan say, the mysterious source of the bright is clear and unstained. The mysterious source of the bright is clear and unstained. Branches of light stream from that dark. The mysterious source of the bright is clear and unstained. Branches of light stream from that dark. Trying to control things is only delusion. But hanging on to the absolute isn't enlightenment either. Trying to control things is only delusion, but hanging on to the absolute isn't enlightenment either. So light and dark, the light flows in the dark flows in the light, everything is contained. Our practice is not about smoothing things out so everything is twilight, but our practice is when the dark comes, we enter the dark fully, and the dark shines with its own light. When the light comes, we enter the light fully, and the dark contains, the light contains the source, the dark source present in each particular thing. And this grasping, this wanting to control is it, and the great absolute, the moments when everything drops away. All of these are contained in each other. And so today, Melissa and I decided that we would share this Dharma talk. So now that I have put the ball in play, she will run the bases, see if we get home.
Oh, I just love sports metaphors. or maybe I don't. I think that I love all of these different translations of this text, which of course really is impossible to translate, even if we spoke and understood 9th century Chinese, it wouldn't make it. We wouldn't understand what this amazing ancestor of ours, Shito, was really pointing to. It's the nature of human beings to carry ourselves forward through using our own stories of the self. And I love John Terence's translation here of, don't limit yourself to your own small story. When I think about what good is it, this text, actually any of these texts, what good are they for helping us through the difficulties of being a human being in a world where there are billions of stories being generated? Every human being has not just one, but many, many, many small stories to help us to make sense of the world. And as David said, this is a healthy thing. If we didn't have that capacity to conceptualize, we wouldn't be able to do very much with our lives. But to know that these are, in fact, constructions, that's the important part. I remember David and I, at some point, we were working through a book that our couples therapist had recommended to us, a kind of workbook on couples therapy. And whoever wrote this book, I can't remember their name right now, said that both people in a relationship are 100% responsible for that relationship. That means that there is 200% responsibility in every relationship. And of course, the human tendency to cling to our small story means that if the other person we encounter doesn't agree with us, then they're just wrong. They're not understanding. In an intimate relationship, this is true. The billions of people in the world, sometimes we encounter stories that are really a lot like our stories. And when I have an overlap that approaches 100% with a person, I feel close to them, I feel connected. But when a gap appears, I feel less connected. It's not because the other person and I are not equally responsible, but it's because we human beings are so tribal that we're always looking for a kind of, well, a 100% overlap in the Venn diagram of the self story. One of the things that you may have noticed during these past few years of trials and tribulations globally, and I always like to say that this is nothing new. There have been trials and tribulations for as long
as human beings have walked the planet. But somehow, particularly all of these things gathering, global warming and the appearance of the coronavirus, political things, the rise of authoritarianism, all of this may be disturbing to us. But if we take a step back and look at our own responsibility for the stories we tell, not just about the self, but about other people and about the planet itself, we might say, well, I didn't cause global warming. I didn't make there be a coronavirus. You must be crazy to say that. But every time we switch on a light, every time we run water from the tap, every time we work from our own greed and anger and ignorance, we are strangely encountering the complete interpenetration of all beings. There are twice the 100% responsibilities in the world times billions. We're all participating, not to blame anyone, but to take on the reality that all of us have contributed to everything, and we are continuing to contribute to it, whether we want to or not. I believe that all people have very good intentions, even people who seem to be doing things that are just awful in the world. And you probably have your own list of who they are and who they've been. But it really doesn't matter. On some very important level, the point is to see how complicit all of us are in all the things that are happening. This is the Zen way of understanding karma. Karma is just a reaction to something, a response to some stimuli. That's all it is, multiplied by billions and trillions and gazillions, multiplied by everything that's ever happened and everything that's happening now. When I say or do anything, sometimes I say and do things that are wise and compassionate, and sometimes I say or do things that are exactly the opposite of that. I always have a positive intention, and I'm sure you all do too, but we don't know enough ever to know how all of the other billions and trillions and quadrillions of elements of reality are joining together to create the response to that that action, that those words, those behaviors. That's why we do the Gatha of Atonement whenever we do our sutra service. That's why we say that there is no knowing. That's why we say in Zen, fall down 10 times, get up 9 times, because we're always falling down. We can't know enough. This not knowing is not it either, as Shito says. This dwelling in the absolute isn't it either. It's not about nothing, and it's not about doing everything right. It's about waking up to the consequences of our actions, of our words, even our thoughts, as it says in the Gatha of Atonement. Everything matters. Everything matters. I always remember a story that the American Hindu teacher Ram Dass, originally Richard Alpert, told about playing a game of frisbee and having just come from a Dharma talk like this, where somebody said, everything matters. You have to be awake to all of your words and deeds and thoughts and actions. And it paralyzed him. The frisbee was coming at him, and he was thinking, if everything matters, what do I do? What do I do? Maybe I'll do the wrong thing. Maybe it'll. And of course, he caught the frisbee and then he sent it off to another person. This is the great game of frisbee that we call being a human being. Not to be paralyzed by our responsibility, but to recognize it. Not to try to get out from under and be perfect and follow the precepts to the letter. That's just, as Wu Men says, tying yourself up with rope. It's to meet each moment, moment after moment, with some kind of wonder, some kind of curiosity. Now what? You could say, now what? Or you could say, now what? And you'll probably say both and other permutations of those words. As life unfolds, all these unexpected things happen. We can't know all the karmic causes and conditions that brought us to this moment. But in this moment, we do our best to be as clear and as awake as possible to our responsibility, our 100% of global warming, our 100% of a miscommunication between two spouses, between two friends, our 100% responsibility to practice as deeply and devotedly as we can. Everyone on this screen made a decision to come to a four-day online traditional Zen practice period called a Sesshin. Sesshin, as you may remember, means to touch the heart mind, to meet the heart mind, to be met by the heart mind, to be met by the truth of reality arising in every moment. Is it the absolute? Is it the relative? Yes. It's everything interconnecting, weaving this great, vast, amazing life that comes to us in all forms. How lucky we are, no matter what we're suffering with, how lucky we are to be able to take this path, to be on the way. Remember Shito's main teaching, whatever meets the eye is the way. After 3.5 days of practicing intensively in our distant temple bell Sesshin, all kinds of things may be meeting your eye and your nose and your tongue and your ears and your body and your mind. Whatever they are, that is the way. Whether it's physical distress or emotional distress or mental distress, whether it's physical comfort or emotional comfort and joy or wonderful clarity and insight in the mind, all elements of the billions and trillions and quadrillions of elements that make up this one moment, all of them changing, transforming, transmuting. So we sit still in the middle of everything. We sit still in this great life that we get to be present in the middle of. The subtle source is clear and bright. The tributary streams flow through the darkness. To be attached to things is illusion. To encounter the absolute is not yet enlightenment. When you walk the way, it is not near, it is not far, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you who study the mystery, do not pass your days and nights in vain. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. We'll have our Dharma dialogue. And I think everyone knows what to do. So we will call on you as we see your raised hands. I also encourage any of you who haven't spoken up yet in a Dharma dialogue or in a practice dialogue so far to take the risk to say something. And we'll start with Adam.
Thank you.
Need to get out of myself here. I was very touched by all of that. I don't even know where to start at the beginning. So I missed a couple sessions yesterday. I had a small family gathering to attend. And one thing that struck me in traveling there was my mind's ability to construct a thought about where I'm supposed to be. So when traffic didn't meet with my expectations, I had all these thoughts like, oh, I'm not going to get there on time, and I'm not going to be able to get back to the sesshin in time. And just observing that was interesting. But once I got where I was going, I felt very much like I was in a koan. I was having a conversation with a cousin of my wife, and I think he knows I practice, and he said something like, so what level of Zen Buddhist are you? And I said, well, that's kind of a loaded question. And he said, or an empty one. And I said, I think we're at the same level. And then we kind of just laughed about it. And we had this great conversation. And at one point he said, we were talking about people's distractions, because there were a bunch of teenagers there with devices and things, you know. And he said, well, people have their distractions. We had ours when we were younger, and everyone has their stories. He's like, and he said something, and I found it really profound. He said, everyone has their stories, but if you listen very closely, they're all telling the same story. And I thought, wow, the mind, the great mind of India. To which he replied, but don't listen to me. I've had a few of these beers. And he wandered off, and I was left, and I was really struck by that. And I was kind of just observing all of the people at this gathering. And there was this one moment, and David, earlier in the talk, when you said, you know, okay, we do this, but what for? You know, like, what, you know, so what, you know, or I can't remember exactly how you phrased it, but so what, or for what? And I looked across the backyard, and my son was sitting on this bench, and he was all by himself, and he was just looking sad and lonely. And I realized that I was seeing myself when I was younger in that situation. Mm. And so I went over and talked to him, and we ended up going and playing badminton and hanging out for like probably 2 hours, just talking, and it was fantastic.
So we're going to just have you pause for a moment. So beautiful to hear how the sesshin carries into everything. You know, in a way, you got to leave and you didn't get any guidelines for reentry like we usually have. I mean, you've heard them many, many times, but then you got to come back. And everything does, at least for me, take on an added resonance when I've been so oriented towards this waking up to both the absolute and the relative, and then you get to see it enacting itself. How beautiful, Adam. Thank you.
Well, and Jeannie spoke last night of the wonder of being with infants and young children, and how vivid. But I think as we wake up, we see every human being we encounter is vivid and offers us the invitation to be with them, just sitting on the fence or in conversation or in the car. And so we receive the Dharma in all the different forms it appears. Yeah, thank you
so much.
Yeah, who else will come forward?
Pierce.
Thank you both. I've been struck by that phrase that David has been using, deep in the mountains. It seems very appropriate to sesshin, and for somebody who has a longing to be deep in the mountains, you know, it has resonance. But I didn't expect to find myself deep in the mountains in my own house, in my own kitchen. And, you know, after Melissa gave that exercise last night, I thought to myself, I've expended so much effort in trying to be present to the skin bag for relatively little return, or at least that's my story. And then suddenly I'm there and it requires no effort at all. And I see the things of my kitchen and my living room. And I want to say that, you know, they seem to me so interesting, but there's nothing of particular interest about them. The thing about them was that it's not that they are interesting, but that they are, that they're there. That's the amazing thing. And this particular state that I was in was not a special state in the least. There were still thoughts coming and going, but there was something very, very reassuring about it. And, you know, I think that I like to say that the closing lines of the grass roof hut are very important to me. But now I see that I've been paying lip service to them, really, you know. this was a confirmation of what Shitu says about they're only to help you to free you from obstructions.
Yeah.
So thank you all.
Well, and as Michael said the other night, since this is an infinite path, we're always just at the beginning. All of us up till this point have just been paying lip service. And the invitation is, and I love how you talk about it. This was not due to your hard work. But we can notice the stories about, well, I haven't had an instant of great enlightenment ever in spite of my hard work. But then something opens and we receive. Each thing has its own intrinsic value. What is that? Oh, here's the fork, right? Here's the clock. Here's the mixing bowl. Oh, is it this close? So intimate. Yeah.
Yeah. We sit. Yunmen says everything shines with its own light. And, you know, we might hear that and go, well, that's pretty dark. I don't understand what he's talking about. But this comparing mind that we all have, I think Adam said it very well, that he's driving to a place and he thinks he should be there rather than in the place where he is. This is so human. And we do it with awakening, too. We think, oh, okay, I've read a lot. I've read all the books on the Boundless Way Zen recommended reading list and more. You know, I mean, all you have to do, you could spend your whole life on Amazon just reading the first paragraphs of books about Zen. But the ideas that can generate in your mind and the comparison can do a disservice. So it affects your own story of the self in a way that might not be so useful. And then that to settle in and go, oh, this is what I've been looking for. It's been here the whole time. That's what I hear in what you're saying, Pierce.
Yeah. And this is part of what Rich was talking about. And I think part of this in the dim and dull reading, Dawi, we laugh and we cry and we silently nod and appreciate our life. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. Will.
Thanks for the talk. I actually, my thoughts have been hanging a little bit on one of the readings that we did, one of the chants, the self and other the same. Of course, we've said it a few times, but the, I mean, many times, but they keep, all of these keep sort of unfolding themselves anew. And this time it's toward the end where I've been thinking about, says, when you face what you have excluded and see how it appears, you must quickly gather it together and integrate with it. Make it work within your house, then establish stable sitting. So, I how do you do that?
But have you had any experience of it?
Well, I guess I'm asking because I have a, I'm building a story and trying not to of failing, I guess, at this. That I've been unusually kind of haunted during the session so far by thoughts about all the things that I should have done already and should be doing now instead of Sesshin, probably, and so on. And sometimes that doesn't come up, but this time, for some reason, it's very insistent. So I've excluded something, but he also says, see how it appears and make it work within your house. And I guess it seems to me like maybe that's the question is, am I really seeing how it appears or how I'm excluding it or, you know?
Well, yeah, I was very struck by that line today too. Those lines, you know, how sometimes you just get, boom, it really gets you. And I think what a great description of what this practice is. Human beings have to exclude things from our minds because otherwise we would be overwhelmed by all the data points, the millions of data points that arise in every moment. I think some scientists measured how much is happening, arising as a thought, emotion, sense perception, 8 million of them in every moment. And we can only be aware of 8. Which is a really small percentage. So we're always excluding things. That's how we construct stories. We have to just pick a few elements, you know, and many of us pick the elements of failure. That's a very, that's a favorite element that we'll weave into our story. And, or I have too much to do and I should be, should is a big element that we will weave into this story. And so, so he says, face what you've excluded, face that, the other 7,000,900 and blah, 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 things that you've excluded. That is, notice what you're not seeing. And this is what happens during Zazen. Things arise, and especially during an intensive retreat like this, things that you maybe haven't wanted to look at because it's too much and it's painful. And I like my story the way it is. Thank you very much. So, so then the next part is you see how it appears. And then you must quickly gather it together and integrate with it. In other words, can you fit something that you've excluded into the self story? I know for me, when that happens, it usually explodes the self story or it shifts the self story quite a bit. It's a really useful thing to have happen. Although, blech, I hate it. I don't want to be disturbed in my self story. I want to maintain it because it's comforting. I like this, you know. When that starts to happen, there's a shaking out that happens. And then you use this new self story, you integrate with it, and then you make it work within your house. You take the new information and you start to say, maybe I'm not who I think I am. Maybe he's not who I think I am. Maybe you're not who I think you are. Maybe I'm not who I think I am. Could I live this way in my own life, my house? And then you establish stable sitting. That's Hongzhi's little formula there. And it takes quite a lot to say, okay, I'll do that. Yeah. So no need to, you can take some of this information. Maybe there's new pieces that you have excluded and see how this information from Hongzhi changes your self story a little bit. And then sit with it. That's what we mean when we say sit with it. And see what arises. See how you start telling yourself a different story.
It also occurs to me that maybe my...
I think we'll go on to a few other people have their hands on up. So we'll go on to some other folks. But thank you so much.
Thanks, Will.
Corwin.
Thank you for... I don't know how many Dharma talks I've just received in the past 45 minutes, but... Melissa, you mentioned a story about a game of Frisbee and how you momentarily, was it Ram Dass, I think, was paralyzed by, you know, how many decisions to make and all this thing. And then finally he just catches the Frisbee. It brought to mind a TV show I binge watched at some point during this pandemic And I won't say which one, just in case people haven't seen it. But that very point kind of comes up, and they realize at some point in the show that no one in the modern world is can possibly not go to the hell realm that existed in this place. Because no matter what anybody did, no matter how hard they tried to do something, it turned out like they never took into account all the causes and conditions.
Right.
And so anything that was good somehow traced back to something bad. And one of the characters freaks out when he was like, oh my God, it's because I was drinking almond milk and you know, I was trying to be good not to drink dairy, but it takes so much water, and this must be why I've gone to this hell. And you know, he made up this story.
Yeah, yeah.
And at some point you just gotta do what you think is right. And even, you know, they realize that even the powers that be in this universe of this TV show, even they got it wrong. So what's right and what's wrong? It's yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, first I want to say that's a great show to binge watch. I won't name it either.
but it will change your life.
but this, everything has its own intrinsic value and is related to everything else in function and position. So each of us utterly alone in the universe, and each of us connected to everything else happening in this world. None of us are pure. Whatever you think, you are a part of this world. And so then we act not to get something else, I guess, nothing else to get, but we act out of our love and out of our wish to wake up. Yeah. So yeah. Thanks, Corwin.
Thank you.
So maybe just one more.
Celia.
Thank you for both of your talks. And I actually was thinking about the person that noticed, that figured out finally what a cloud was.
Yes.
And how precious that moment was, because that happens a lot with little children. It happens so often, and we love it, don't we? We just love it that when a child figures something out, and then we become older and older, and you know, we don't notice how much we're figuring out, and the figuring out of things becomes more connected to a lot of other things and a little harder to just notice it. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about one of the reasons that I retired is this grandchild that I'm going to be spending more time with. And another is that I have a cousin who's developmentally disabled, and he can't talk, and I'm going to be spending more time with him. Mm. And I just, that's when you talked about that, I realized that this is going to be special for me to try to just be open to who he is now. And
right.
Yeah. So that's all. Thank you for.
Like Jeannie's talk last night and Adam's talk, you know, we do meet Zen teachers everywhere. Mm. And we get as adults, we accumulate knowledge, and we believe, this is not just stories about the self, but stories about everything. You know, I know what a tree is. I know what a cloud is. I know who you are, and I know who I am. But we don't really know anything. These are useful constructions because they help us get through. And people like a cousin?
Yeah.
Your cousin, like the woman who saw the cloud, small children. They're teachers for us, not because we should be like them. I really want my grandson to start constructing narratives so that he can, you know, grow up and live in the world, live a full life. but the that quality, we do lose it, the quality of surprise and awe and discovery that is really possible. And I think that's one of the reasons I love Zen so much. It, when I came to Zen, it affirmed the part of me that had been left latent. You know, the right, I was in graduate school, I think, or maybe just about to start when I met my first Zen teacher. No, it was before I met, yeah, but I was like, I knew there was something missing. Mm. And I heard him talk and he was pointing to exactly that thing, that there's more going on here than we think. And I just want to quickly talk about that wonderful television show that everyone should binge watch. But not until the session is over, please. One of the things that happens a lot in the first season is all this really strange stuff is going on. And people keep trying to make sense of it. And it's like, it's impossible to make sense of it. And there's a certain point when things are revealed about why nothing makes sense. And I remember this feeling of surprise and awe, just like when I was a kid, that wow, I see why that happened and this happened and that happened. Something sort of, so it's not just not knowing, it's also things cohering and making a bigger sense, you know, like what's the name of the teacher who talks about a bigger container?
Joko Beck.
She talks about Zen really gives us a bigger container, keeps expanding. It's not just that we drop the stories, we can't, but it expands the stories. We look at each other and we see how we're all suffering so much. And a lot of the suffering comes from our limited views. So expansion. Yeah. Yeah. So thank you so much, Celia. And thank you to everyone. And we'll take a few moments to sit together now and our upright practice of being human.